Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 1 week ago, you could feel a shift happening. Americans suddenly seemed convinced that coronavirus was spreading in the United States and that each of us has a responsibility to slow that spread. This week, the numbers of confirmed cases skyrocketed. Congress approved almost $1 trillion in relief, and healthcare workers on the front lines braced for what many public health experts say will be a surge of patients needing care in the coming days. From the public health efforts to flatten that curve to the politics and the government's response, we want to slow down and understand this week, a very busy week in the news. So to help us do that, we have Rick Burke. He is the co-founder and executive editor of STAT, a media company focused on health, medicine, and science. Rick, thanks so much for coming back to On Point.
Sure thing, Meghna. I was, as you know, I was on last week, and it feels like a decade ago. It's dizzying how the world is changing by the minute. And it was the last time I was out of the house was to do the show. And little did I know, no more leaving the front door.
Wow. So you haven't been out of the house in a week?
No.
Okay.
No.
And how's that been for you?
I think, like for any of us, we're just grateful for our health, and I don't want to say I didn't like step out to get milk or whatever,
okay.
but I think it's hard for all of us it's one thing to work from home for a day or two here or there, but it's another thing to feel you really need to stay put.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rick, hang on here for just a second because we're also joined today by Kimberly Atkins. She's WBUR's senior news reporter covering national politics, and she joins us from Washington. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Meghna.
And how are you doing, Kimberly?
Luckily, there's a lot to keep me busy, so I am doing okay.
Okay, good. That's good to hear. I mean, quite frankly, like we're going to check in with all of our guests for now until the foreseeable future, just on a human note, just to be sure everyone's all right, at least for the time being. Rick, first of all, let me just ask you, we want to spend the first part of this conversation kind of getting up to date, not on the politics per se, but on just the shape of the epidemic so far. I'm curious, do you care to speculate about how long people might have to go through this adjusted way of living?
Well, Meghna, we had an interesting piece from Helen Branswell that we published this morning that talked about what countries have done it right and beat back the coronavirus and the techniques they've used. And low down in the story, there was a quote from a professor at University of Minnesota, Michael Osterholm, who said, "We have to get out of this mindset that this is a blizzard that's 2 or 3 days and we're home and dealing with it." He said, we have to think of this as a coronavirus winter, and this is going to be a long season. And I think that quote put it very well. This is something we're in for the long haul. We don't know how long, but this isn't just a few days where we need to stay inside.
Okay.
And that's very, I think, concerning and frightening for all of us, but it's the reality.
Okay. Well, we want to sort of beat back fear with facts here. So where are we then in this terms of the spread of the disease so far in the United States? I mean, in New York, we saw a spike in the reported number of cases. That spike comes along with increased testing there. So how would you describe the sort of the shape of the epidemic right now?
Well, I would say it's just changing by the moment. But right now we have, at this moment, the best we know, 242,708 confirmed cases globally. Deaths globally, almost 10,000, 98,067. And right now, the top, and again, with all of this, with the caveat that so much testing hasn't gone on, that the numbers are probably much higher. But from what we know, the top states are where their numbers of confirmed cases. We have New York with 5,366 and California with 952. But it seems like every time we turn around and have new testing, the numbers just spike in states around the country. So that's where we are right now.
Yeah. And we're hearing that hospitals now feel like maybe in certain places they're days away from that expected surge of patients.
Right. They're all bracing. Some are more ready than others. We had an interview yesterday with a ICU nurse in Seattle, which we know has been really hard hit. And she, I thought she offered some very useful advice, which was to people who are worried, don't rush into a hospital. Call. There's a lot of hotlines being set up around the country. Call the hotlines. Don't panic or bombard the ERs, because the big fear, obviously, is people who don't have it could run into the hospitals and then get infected by people who do have it, and everyone's mixed up in there, and it's just bad news for everyone. So they're trying to, I think her wisdom was, let's be smart about this, anticipating that there's going to be a real, real problem with capacity at these hospitals.
Right. And people shouldn't rush to the hospital either, because some folks may not yet need urgent care well. Now, I'm wondering, Rick, if you could help us sort of be sure that we're seeing the whole picture here, because I'm going to go back to those numbers that you told us about the approximately 242,000 confirmed cases globally, right? And
right.
A little over 10,000 deaths globally. I didn't quite catch the exact number that you said, but it was more than 10,000. But if I read that correctly, though, what we should also remind folks not at all to downplay the seriousness of this, because it is serious. But we also should remind folks that the vast majority of people do survive this. And I think sometimes just in our conversations about it, when we're in the midst of all this intense coverage, I think it's worth reminding people about that. Do you?
I think so too, and I think again, it's part of the import of our not panicking and not thinking the worst, but also taking all the precautions we can. And it's a balance between sort of overreacting, but also taking this very seriously, and maybe a little overreaction and over concern is a good thing here, because there may be a temptation for people. Well, maybe I can go out, maybe I can talk to a family member or go see a family member. And I think wherever there's a question about what one should do, the answer should be, let's be careful and strict and not take any chances at all. And I think all of us, as the days wear on, are more and more aware that this is it may not be deadly for everyone, but this is really serious. And if we're going to do anything to mitigate this rush on hospitals around the country the hospitals lacking capacity, the only way to deal with that is to stop the spread now. And we looked at some scenarios, and you could have a scenario where in a couple weeks hospitals around the country are overloaded and swamped and it's catastrophic, or you could have a scenario where they're handling it just okay, and it all really depends on the spread and the behavior of people who sort of interact with one another, and we can ourselves have some control of this and whether it's contained or not.
That is so right, Rick, and so important. I mean, you know, it's been a while, I think, since all of us globally, but also especially here in the United States, have been confronted with something where part of the solution is each and every one of us as individuals. We are all part of what needs to be done to be sure that we have the best outcomes possible as we're grappling with an epidemic, with a global pandemic. So, but about those hospitals, I just want to play a clip of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He was on CNN yesterday. New York is now the hardest hit state in the United States with about 3,000 confirmed coronavirus cases. And Governor Cuomo believes the number is actually much higher. And he says New York hospitals are preparing for a wave of patients needing care.
This is a war. Treat it like a war. Say to the manufacturers in this country, I need you to build these pieces of equipment quickly. Certainly the gear, the machine next to me, the ventilator. This is going to be the matter of life and death for people. We now have about 5,000-6,000 ventilators in New York State. We're going to need about 30,000 ventilators.
Rick Burke, you want to respond to what Governor Cuomo said there?
Well, I think he's an example of being very aggressive in saying this is very serious and we have to take it that way. And it's interesting. One of the things we're hearing just in the last 24 hours, it may seem like a small thing, but it goes to my point about not doing things that you thought were okay even a few days ago. But if you order out for a food delivery, and you know, maybe a week ago we would have thought that was fine because it's just one person delivering food and there's not a crowd of people. But now I think there's a realization that you're putting that delivery worker at risk and you're putting yourself at risk.
Wow. And so then, I mean, so then that means that the ripple effect of this coronavirus outbreak is going to spread even further with every passing day if people.
I think that's the real concern. And one thing I think about Cuomo, when you see about his proactive measures, it's just really interesting to look at a little of the history that we have, just the recent history of what other countries are doing. And again, my colleague Helen Branswell of Stat has a good piece today where she examines what other countries have done to beat it back and the techniques. And the one that she emphasizes is Singapore, where the numbers have ticked up, but it hasn't exploded because in her view, they've done everything right. Mm-hmm. They've tracked down people who have the infection and ordered them to stay at home and be quarantined. These proactive measures really make a difference.
Yeah. Well, Rick Burke, co-founder of Stat, stand by for a second. And Kimberly Atkins, thank you for being so patient with us as we wanted to get sort of the health update of coronavirus. We'll talk about politics and we'll take a close look at what's happening in California when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the week in review and a historic week in the United States. I'm joined today by Rick Burke. He's co-founder of Stat, a media company focused on health, medicine, and science. And Kimberly Atkins is also with us. She's senior news correspondent for WBUR covering national political news. She's with us from Washington. So, Kimberly, let us focus on that national political news coming out of Washington all week. We had this question from listener Kay from Rochester, Michigan.
What I would like to know, this relief package that the Senate and the House and the president has signed up for and released. What are the details of it as far as the consumer, when it comes to the consumer itself? How much is each individual or is it per household? Is there any details, further details on the package itself?
That's from Kay in Michigan. So, Kimberly, what are the details about the relief packages that were passed this week?
Well, so far, the relief, the packages that were passed this week so far are not the ones that are consumer focused. They are the ones that are meant to shore up other parts of the economy. What I believe Kay is really focused on is what is being deliberated right now, which would be the third and largest relief package that directed at coronavirus response, and that would send money to individuals, to households. Senate Republicans released a plan that would give most households $1,200 for each adult and $500 for each child, that number would decrease the higher the income of the household, and those making $100,000 or more would not get that relief. And also those who don't have any federal income would get less in that. So far, that is going to the Democrats to look it over. So far, they don't like what they see because they say, according to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leaders in the House and Senate, that it focuses too much on corporations and industry and not enough on individuals. This package would also include low interest loans to go to industries such as airline companies and other travel companies who have been hit really hard. They say it focuses too much on that and not enough on the consumers. Some individual Democrats have proposed granting individuals much more, as much as $4,000 per adult and $2,000 per each child. So that is what is going to be hashed out starting today. Lawmakers said they had hoped to pass something by the beginning of next week to get this money to consumers quickly. But looking at how far apart they still are at this point, that seems unlikely.
Oh, interesting. Now, to be clear, when folks who have no sort of federally taxable, who don't end up paying federal tax, for a lot of them, it's because they are very low income earners, right?
That's exactly right. And that's one of the complaints. Look, on the one hand, economists look at it and say, well, you can't be giving tax breaks or tax credits to someone that's greater than the amount of taxes that they pay in. On the other hand, people are saying this is a crisis. And if people who are very low income earners, they are the first people who are going to feel the impact of this crisis. And it's an obligation of the government to help them and give them assistance, not just for them, not only for them personally, but if they fall below the ability to take care of themselves, that produces another drag on the economy so that they're doubly incentivized to do it. So those are that's the push and pull that's going to be happening in Washington over the next several days.
I mean, this is such a strange moment and such an unprecedented moment. It does make you wonder if a purely economic lens is the best way to be looking at what the function or purpose of a government stimulus or relief package should be, right? I mean, it sounds like that's the heart of the political debate going on.
That's absolutely right. Look, we are dealing with something that this generation has never seen before. I mean, not since post-World War II has there even been an attempt at this size of a stimulus package for the U.S. economy. And it's also meant to say to Americans, look, we know that this is frightening. We know that we don't even know how long this is going to last. And to ease fears and concerns and to make Americans feel like, yes, we can get through this collectively together so that there is not panic, so that there is not distrust in the government. So it is more than just an economic calculation for sure.
Right. So, Kimberly, just to be clear, you said that Republican and Democratic leaders are meeting today, right?
Correct.
To further hash out those details.
They are going to meet today, and just the Democratic leaders signaled ahead of time that they are not happy with what the Republicans have offered so far.
And in a best case scenario, perhaps they could come to some agreement by early next week?
That's the hope. I mean, everyone is incentivized to move on this quickly, including Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who has been working with the White House and also with Nancy Pelosi on this and other stimulus packages. Everybody is greatly incentivized. The urgency is certainly being felt from all of the players here. So they all know that sooner is better than later.
Right. But then even if that did come to pass, it would still be several weeks at least before the money was actually successfully delivered to Americans.
That's likely. The numbers that I'm hearing from lawmakers will be about 2 weeks. They would, of course, move as quickly as possible. But yes, it will still be some time. And as we've been speaking about, we've already seen how things have changed so quickly in 1 week with unemployment claims skyrocketing and lots of layoffs happening. So 2 weeks can feel like an eternity.
Well, I'm completely in agreement with what Rick told us at the top of the show, that even just this past 1 week has felt like a decade.
Right.
Rick, I just want to give you a quick chance to respond to sort of the relief packages that have been slowly working their way through Washington. What do you think about them?
As you all said, it's sort of an interesting lens to look at all this, but it's hard for me to keep track of what's going on there and the health concerns and what we're seeing with Newsom ordering 40 million Californians to stay in their houses. So I guess I'm more focused on that element of it than what's happening with Washington. Yeah. And as Kimberly said, it's really I can't think of in our lifetimes any kind of package like this. Mm-hmm. It's unprecedented.
Well, Rick, that's why you and Kimberly are a perfect tag team today with the health coverage and the politics and economic coverage.
Right.
But you did mention California, which is a very, very important part of what happened this week. I want to play a moment from what California Governor Gavin Newsom announced just last night. He put into place a stay-at-home order for the entire state of California. That's 40 million residents. His assessment, the governor's assessment, is that half of Californians could become infected by coronavirus.
We are confident that the people of the state of California will abide by it. They'll do the right thing. They'll meet this moment. They'll step up, as they have over the course of the last number of weeks, to protect themselves, to protect their families, and to protect the broader community in this great state and the world that we reside in.
It's California's Governor Gavin Newsom just last night. Well, joining us now via Skype from San Francisco is Hana Baba. She's host of Cross Currents, the daily magazine show on KALW, and co-host of the podcast The Stoop, which tells stories from across the Black diaspora. Hana, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first of all, we're doing check-ins with everybody here for the next, you know, many weeks as we go through this. How have you been doing?
Oh, let me tell you, I have two teenagers in the house doing the online learning. We as media are part of essential services, so we can go to work. But our station has decided that we should work from home, which, you know, has its own challenges with audio. We're in radio and so. It's all fine though, Megan. We will adapt.
We will. I keep wanting to say, like, I'm not being a Pollyanna. This is serious, but we will also all get through this together. But Hana, so you being in San Francisco, you have been on essentially a form of stay-at-home order for a while, but now that is across the entire state of California. Can you give us a sense as to why Governor Newsom felt the need to take that step yesterday?
I think today we're all waking up to these numbers that Gavin Newsom, the governor, set out last night. Newsrooms today are going to be scrambling to try to make sense of the 25 million Californians that could be affected by the virus, as he says, by 8 weeks. And just breaking that down, trying to understand, we're going to be calling public health experts, we're going to be calling the epidemiologists to understand how this number came about. But, you know, as you said, we've been in this shelter in place order since Monday. So what California is now being ordered to do, we've been doing it for around a week or so. Only essential services, groceries, banks, safety services. Our schools may be closed till the summer. And, you know, there are so many other issues that kind of are underneath the surface that a lot of people are really not thinking about on the surface, but our newsroom is trying to tackle the homelessness that is part of the San Francisco Bay Area's story for such a long time right now. Silicon Valley, working from home. Our story with coronavirus kind of started with the Princess cruise ship, which mm-hmm. is still docked in San Francisco Bay. You drive past the bridge, it's right there between the Oakland skyline and the San Francisco skyline. And so we will be, you know, talking about all of this all this week and for the weeks to come, and just trying to dig into all of it.
Yeah. So tell me more about how you know, California's diverse communities are responding to this, because this is an all-encompassing event that we're experiencing. But as these things go, like sometimes very frequently, the events hit certain communities harder than others.
For sure. I mean, here in the Bay Area so far, we have about 443 cases. Again, these numbers you know, depend on who you ask, but the formal official number is 443. A lot of them are in Santa Clara County, which has a heavy Asian American population. A lot of them are in Alameda County, which includes Oakland and Berkeley, also with large Latino populations, Latinx populations, and African American populations. You know, and just, you know, we've been trying in our reporting to do the fault line reporting, right? Which is, how does an issue cover everybody, but also how does it cover people specifically mm-hmm. regarding, you know, their geography, their race, their gender? And it has been hitting communities of color and vulnerable communities in a big way. One of the stories I personally am working on is looking at the shelters in the area, the women's shelters. What happens to abused women when the husbands are staying at home all day, right? So are their shelters open? Are they not? And sadly, you know, they're at capacity. So what happens then? It's hard for a newsroom, right? Because there are our editorial meetings are just full of all of these different populations of people that we're thinking about and yeah. how this is affecting them in their different ways. And it's hard to kind of know what to cover, what not to cover in these situations. But, you know, you just do the best you can. But those are some populations that we're specifically looking at that are impacted in a big way. The schools, right? When you say school closures until summer, how many children are dependent on the breakfast and the lunch that comes from the school, or just a place to stay off the streets, right? To stay out of trouble, to stay away from the abuse at home. So this is the stuff that we are starting to think about in addition to big picture things as well.
Yeah. Well, Hana, one more question for you. How have Californians felt, or how, if you have a sense of it, in terms of how Governor Newsom has been handling this crisis as it's unfolding, mm-hmm. about how, you know, what the messages and aid or help coming from Washington is? Because it seems as if this is another one of those moments where perhaps there's not as much coordination between state and federal government as maybe there ought to be.
Well, we all know the relationship between Washington and our state has not been the best one, right? Since President Trump has been in office, there's been a lot of tension there. But I think what people are looking at right now, this $1 billion that Gavin Newsom last night asked for, you know, it's going to basic things, right? Like protective equipment. Nurses right now in the Bay Area are protesting outside of the hospitals asking for personal protective equipment, not enough masks, not enough gloves. It's the basic thing. So I think from the tone of the governor yesterday, he even kind of gave a little nod to the president, right? Like to the federal government. It feels like there's going to be a cooling of that tense relationship between California and federal government. And I think this is the time for that.
Right. So let me just jump in here because I want to play a clip for you. This is the president, President Trump, at the White House briefing yesterday. He deferred responsibility for much of the coronavirus response to the states. For example, you talked about personal protective equipment, Hana. Here's what the president said about the shortage of masks and ventilators.
The federal government's not supposed to be out there buying vast amounts of items and then shipping. You know, we're not a shipping clerk. The governors are supposed to be, as with testing, the governors are supposed to be doing it. We'll help out, and we'll help out wherever we can, and we can buy in volume, and in some cases, great volume, with the masks, as an example, which were really a problem. We have helped out, and there are right now millions of masks being made. But this is really for the local governments, governors, and people within the state, depending on the way they divide it up. And they'll do that, and they're doing a very good job of it.
It's the president yesterday at the White House. Hana, what do you think about that?
That's exactly what I was talking about. California and President Trump haven't been on the best terms. You know, all of the policies that he's been issuing regarding immigration, regarding environment, right? California's been raising suing the federal government. But it feels like this is a time when everyone has agreed this is a national pandemic and we need to set our, hopefully this is what is happening. We need to kind of focus on this. And, you know, I hope they really do that. I hope it's not just rhetoric.
Yeah. Well, Hana Baba is host of Cross Currents, a daily magazine show on KALW and co-host of the podcast, The Stoop, with us from San Francisco. Hana, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Kimberly Atkins, we've got about 30 seconds before the break. But what do you make of sort of the relationship between the White House or the federal government and governors right now?
Yeah, it's been contentious at times. We've seen that play out openly with Governor Cuomo in New York, for example. You know, in Massachusetts, Charlie Baker is saying that some of the items that he's sought to get, he's been outbid by the government, by the federal government. It is not smooth sailing. It hasn't been over the past few weeks, which is just one more impediment.
And we need it to be as smooth as possible as we all continue to grapple with this. So Kimberly Atkins and Rick Burke, hang on here for just a second. We'll talk a lot more about this incredible week in the news when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are taking a look at the week in review, an historic week, perhaps the first of several to come. And I'm joined today by Rick Burke. He's co-founder and executive editor of STAT, a media company that's focused on health, medicine, and science and has been doing some extraordinary reporting on coronavirus. And Kimberly Atkins is also with us. She's in Washington. She's senior news correspondent for WBUR covering national political news. And Kimberly and Rick, I just wanted to play some voicemails we got from listeners from a couple of different states, really showing some support, throwing their support behind their state governors. Here's Preston from Dayton, Ohio, who wants to give a shout out to his governor, Mike DeWine.
I was just calling to say how extremely happy I am with Governor Mike DeWine. And I think a lot of the government is too, Republicans and Democrats. Even been mentioned multiple times by President Trump for his quick action on shutting down bars and restaurants, now gyms and salons and tattoo parlors, going almost as far as demanding if you can work from home, the employer needs to be responsible enough to allow people to do that.
That's Preston from Dayton, Ohio. And here's what Diane from Spokane, Washington had to say about her governor.
I'm just calling to commend my home state of Washington and Governor Inslee for their prompt and appropriate response to the coronavirus epidemic. And I'd like to comment negatively on President Trump, who turned around and called our governor a snake on public media. I find that most unpresidential, especially in this emergency time.
That's Diane from Spokane in Washington State. Now, Rick Burke, let me turn back to you about sort of some of the other things that the president has said during the press briefings this week. Yesterday, I believe, he talked about drug development. You wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Right. It's, I mean, at STAT, we cover drug development. That's sort of what we do. And our several of our reporters collectively fell out of their chairs yesterday watching that press conference because and they wrote a story saying President Trump today undermined six decades of dogma on the development of drugs. He said some things that were just mind-boggling to many of us. He said a new drug for COVID-19 was, quote, approved or very close to being approved. He said another drug in development would be quote, available almost immediately, and we're going to try it out because, quote, it's not going to kill anybody. And this is just unheard of. And you don't have to be a partisan for Republican or Democrat to say that's just not true. And I mean, the drug development process, even on a fast track, takes months, if not years. And the new FDA commissioner, Stephen Hahn, sort of delicately got on the stage after Trump and tried to walk it all back. But what we're hearing is just not true.
It's just not true. Okay. But he's up there saying it.
But he's up there saying it. And it's interesting because you mentioned the reader feedback from other governors. And I thought that was, frankly, very heartening to hear people, Republicans and Democrats, saying, you know, we like our how our governor's handling it. And this is these are the moments that really test the mettle of a leader of a state or of a country. And I think they're going to be inevitable comparisons between what a governor Inslee or a governor DeWine, how they comport themselves, a governor Newsom, Governor Cuomo, how they comport themselves versus the president and what they say that's true and not true and sort of their calmness under pressure.
Mm. Well, Kimberly Atkins, let me turn back to you because I think we're seeing various degrees of this from different parts of Washington, because I'm remembering back to the bill that the president did sign this week, earlier in the week or over the weekend. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was touting the passage of the bill as a really big win because it was supposed to give, for example, paid sick leave, a creation of a paid sick leave policy for American workers. But it has so many exemptions in it. For example, it exempts companies employing more than 500 workers, that there are millions of American workers who will not receive this benefit, even though it was a supposedly one of the successful bills passed this week.
Yes. It just shows that push and pull. There was a lot of wrangling over everything from the Hyde Amendment to other things just to get the second bill that went through that was, you know, really urgently needed because that funded things like testing that allowed Americans, if the test is available to them, which is another question, to get that testing for free if they are symptomatic. And other things that were really needed. So it just shows how difficult the political wrangling can still be, even at a time of an emergency, and even when all parties involved are motivated to get things done. The same with the push and pull between the federal government and state governments. A lot of these states and local officials, too, began moving because they weren't getting guidance from the federal government. We were hearing from state and local officials that they were waiting for this guidance, and they just weren't getting it. And they were hearing from doctors, hearing from citizens, hearing from other folks that we reporters hear from, too, really needing this assistance. And so they began acting on their own.
Mm. Well, there's one more story out of Washington, Kimberly, that I want to touch on you with. And that is, you know, I think people's growing distaste about what they're learning about how certain lawmakers may have been behaving in the past couple of weeks or a month here. So, for example, Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler, she's under scrutiny for selling stocks and buying stocks in telecom companies that perhaps would be benefiting from more people working from home and making these stock transactions after a Senate briefing with the president, the vice president, and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. So let's listen.
We talked in the meeting today about some additional responses that the administration is looking to take to make sure that consumers are protected, that we have all the medical testing that we need, and that the economy stays strong. The good news is the consumer is strong, the economy is strong, jobs are growing. Our president has done a fantastic job making sure that we're in the best position to manage through this situation.
So that's what Senator Loeffler said, even as it's reported she was selling a lot of stock. And she's not the only one. NPR has reported that North Carolina Senator Richard Burr also sold about $1.6 million in stocks right before the market began tanking. Now, both of them denied that stock sales were related to any information they got in their official capacities. But we also have a new statement from Senator Burr here. He says, quote, I relied solely on public news reports to guide my decision regarding the sale of stocks on February 13th. He's also now asked the chair of the Senate Ethics Committee to open a complete review of the matter with full transparency. So, Kimberly, what do you think?
I mean, at the very least, this is a terribly bad look. You have Senator Burr, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, who is privy to a lot of information, including potential threats from things like a burgeoning pandemic. And you have Kelly Loeffler, whose husband is the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. And so it's very interesting to she also says that her stock decisions were made by a third party and she had no part of it. But that's very difficult. You know, that's a tough set of circumstances. It's very difficult to prove intent for something like this. But politically, it's very, very damaging. And there are a lot of questions that they will continue to have to answer as to how and why the timing of those stock trades happened the way they did.
Right. I mean,
and I think what Kimberly says is absolutely true. And this pandemic has brought out the best and the worst in our elected officials. But when Kimberly says this is going to drag out, this is the last thing we all need to be dealing with right now is ethics investigations of members of Congress and how they're responding to this. It's just really a shame that we've ended up here with these members of Congress.
Right. And even, I mean, in the midst of, at any time, but especially in the midst of a crisis like this, the perception,
right,
even just the perception is harmful enough because Rick, in the midst of a public health crisis, the last thing the public needs is to lose faith in what their leaders are saying, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one thing, Meghna, if I could just
please
mention that was very helpful to me. We, you know, how every day you see Trump and a whole phalanx of people behind him. And we asked one of our reporters, Lev Fasher, to sort of identify who does what in the administration. Who are these people? And because as we know, early on, Trump, for better or for worse, resisted having a czar like there was for in the Obama administration, an Ebola czar. He resisted a coronavirus czar. And maybe that was fine. But there was sort of a parade of people in charge from Mike Pence to Birx to the Alex Azar. So Lev did a story that lists 16 people and what their role is in the administration. Many of those people who flank Trump at those daily press conferences. And it was just really eye-opening to me to see what everyone does. And in some ways it was clarifying because you could realize, okay, that explains, that's the lane of this official. This official is responsible for dealing with testing. This mm-hmm. this official is responsible for dealing with Congress. So it did give me a little sense of that and clarity. And it also was interesting seeing one of the odd men out of this is Robert Redfield, who's the CDC director, who's kind of disappeared, vanished
right
from being at those briefings. And it's because and the CDC should be central to this, but there have been tensions between the CDC and Trump in the White House over testing.
Wow. Well, I mean, we spoke to a former CDC director earlier this week, Tom Frieden, who said he's very troubled that the CDC isn't in that lineup at those daily press briefings. But Rick Burk, co-founder and executive editor of STAT. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure thing.
And by the way, STAT is doing some fabulous reporting right now. Statnews.com is where to go, or you can go to onpointradio.org and we'll link to them. And Kimberly Atkins, senior news correspondent for WBUR, covering national political news with us from Washington. Kimberly, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Meghna. You be well.
You too. And in fact, folks, you may not be used to hearing me on Fridays because Fridays is usually when my colleague, the marvelous David Folkenflik, runs the show here at On Point. And he is with us now. He is On Point host and editor and NPR media correspondent. But these are strange times. And so sometimes getting people to the studios where they need to get is a little harder than it should be. But David, you're on the line with us now. Hi there, David.
Hey, Meghna. Good to hear your voice, as always.
You too. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine at this point. You know, I think that one of the things you learn as an adult, particularly as a parent, is, which you and I both are, is to grapple with life with uncertainty rather than perfect clarity. And I think we're all of us, listeners, people there at BUR, at NPR, all of us are doing just that, sort of writ large. And it's complicated, but now that we have some sense of what our uncertainty is, rather than uncertainty about our uncertainty, not to get too Rumsfeldian about it, it's a little easier, but it's scary too. And, you know, like you, you know, I've got young kids and we have questions and they have even more questions and you have to find ways of answering them without misleading them.
Yeah. And I mean, one of my goals is to be sure that my kids come out of this with a sense of confidence about their world. I mean, even if we're sort of in this particular period for several months, because it, you know, I mean, this is unprecedented. It could really change the way people think about the world, don't you think, David?
It's amazing on a number of levels. You know, I think about you think about questions of learning and interacting, what social activity means. My mom is a retired college faculty member out in California, is going to give a video lecture to several kids this afternoon here in the home about Greek myths and gods and goddesses and narrative, and, you know, do it to an age-appropriate level. And that's a way of communing as well. You know, she's not able to go to Shabbat dinner tonight, which she'd been looking forward to, appropriately distanced physically, but maybe social interaction. But the governor, Newsom, as you talked about earlier this hour, has said everybody should shelter in place. And so that's a new enforcement of strictures. You think about what's happening in Washington and in states around the country, you know, as well as hospitals around the country. We're all kind of doing a mental triage, even as healthcare professionals are gearing up to do kind of a medical triage, that is to decide how to set priorities, what to focus on, what not to. Well, that's happening in all kinds of life. Rick Burke just talked about the last thing we need right now is to have a Senate Ethics Committee investigation of Senator Richard Burr and others who may well have traded on information they got from the coronavirus before the public was being really told the truth about what the full nature of the threat was from our public officials and public establishment. Well, we don't need that in a sense. And so there is kind of a public triage going on in what we do. But people need to have confidence and clarity on what their choices are and what they're confronting. And they have to do that with knowledge that we don't entirely know. And we don't know what our time frames are. And so we have to wrap our minds around that and find ease and let kids be kids. Let them learn. Let them grow. Let them struggle. Let them have fun. Let them comfort within whatever confines we have and whatever ways we have available. So it's a, you know, it is a time for our humanity to surface and to try to take a breath and be patient with each other in the public and private spheres. But it is a test.
Yeah. You know, I am seeking and trying to focus on a sense of purpose right now as well, because as we talked about earlier in the hour, this is a moment where we all can take individual actions for the collective good, for our own personal health and well-being, but also for the collective good. And I find that to actually be a source of inspiration to help battle back some of that uncertainty.
Yeah, you know, like, I mean, you think of all those kids down on spring break being interviewed by various TV stations and, you know, saying, hey, we put deposits, we've been waiting this whole year. There are a lot of kids who are having, you know, graduation ceremonies, athletic contests and tournaments, all kinds of things in which they took great pride and effort being wiped away. You know, rather than trashing those kids, you hope that they learn and mature and that this is a moment that they take from it and said, okay, well, this may not hurt me terribly, but maybe it could hurt a parent or a loved one with a compromised immune system or a grandparent. Yeah. And for that matter, let's think about information and misinformation. It shouldn't be that something has to hit you or your loved one for you to take it seriously. And it shouldn't be that that happens has to happen to the families and loved ones of public officials,
right,
for them to take it seriously too. But sometimes that's where we are.
Well, David, I'm keeping the seat warm for you here. David Folkenflik, On Point host and editor and NPR media correspondent. Thanks so much, David. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.